Why did the golfer wear two pairs of pants to the golf course? In case you got a hole in one. You're listening to the podcast with a K. I'm Christian Corley. We're here to talk about Doctor Who. And I say we because I'm back with Brian Turnover and James McLean. Now, I know I'm probably the only person who dances to the theme tune, but I really felt like I busted some moves there.
I got that.
Did you?
I did, totally. Yeah, I'm almost out of breath.
You busted some moves.
I did. I may have broken a few fingernails at it as well as I waved my arms around like some sort of drunk stick insect. But anyway, welcome, guys. We haven't had a chat for a little while. You've been enjoying some sort of well-earned rest in the busy world that is 2021. That's a joke. Mm. And I've chatted to Gareth Cavanagh and Philip Bates on separate occasions whilst you've been hibernating.
It's the best way, isn't it? Best way to get through 21.
What, talking to Gareth or hibernating?
Hibernating. Well, I mean, Gareth's a good guy. I mean, you could do worse than Gareth.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's, in a way, perhaps one of the things that we'll be talking about today, which I think is kind of nice from a purely reflective point of view from ourselves, is that we do have quite a good group of people that we've been working with on this, I dare call it show, digital artifact, whatever, these last, well, way over 10 years now, certainly in the form it is at the moment, the regeneration that it is at the moment. Everyone we've dealt with has been really good, you know, in terms of as a space of fandom, which is my little segue for you.
For me?
Christian, the segue.
Is that for me? Was that one for me? Was it? Okay.
I'm laying the path here, laying it down.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's a polished production as ever. And we are basically going to have a chat and think about all the amazing things that Doctor Who fans have been able to do over the years. Because it is a show that has its detractors and its supporters. It is never as good as people claim it is, and it's never as bad as the other people claim it is. Timer and the Rani notwithstanding. And I'm joking, obviously. And often 55. No, but seriously, though, there is... The thing is, Doctor Who survives not just on the grace of the BBC, but also of the people that love it in ways that allows them to be inspired by it and go off and create their own things. We've all created our own things in different ways over the years. This podcast is an, as James referred to, an artifact of our affection, I think is probably the best way to describe it, towards this really silly show. Brian Terranova makes things that you can watch. James and I, and Brian as well, have worked on a website and podcasts and magazines. Fanzines. Yeah.
Done a lot of stuff on this.
We have, yeah. James has also done things professionally linked to Doctor Who. And and Brian does, you've made some lovely films.
Yeah, absolutely. Made films, obviously. You know, people can search out the PDF files on the website as well for the
Of course, there's Sonic Screwdriver.
Prop bits, the Sonic Screwdrivers. You know, so in the prop and cosplay community as well. But on the fan film side of thing, you know, I think when you're a fan of something to the degree that many of us are, you know, and there's no greater kind of proof of this than say David Tennant or Peter Capaldi, who were fans of the show and always wished one day themselves to become the Doctor. And I think we all kind of in some way, or many of us do, sit there and want that to happen as well, especially if you already have an interest in acting or filmmaking. So it's just a natural thing for someone like me who has an interest in acting and filmmaking and who would like to be the Doctor and so on to step somehow into fan filmmaking or audio dramas or things like that. And it was something, you know, I always wanted to do it as a teenager, and resources were limited at the time, but we tried, you know, and now everybody's got a little home movie studio on their home computer.
Yeah.
It's so easy to do. It's a fun creative outlet. And that, I think that's one of the biggest things for me. It's a fun creative outlet. You know, it is wonderful writing the stories, acting the stories. I get lost in the editing, to be honest, because those of you will have no idea, the listeners right now will have no idea what just happened here, but we were supposed to start this podcast about 10 minutes prior to starting, and I myself was lost in editing and missed the fact that I was supposed to be on the show, because I get so immersed, I get so involved, and it's a lot of fun, and it's just so easy to forget the world around you when you're doing this, and especially in the world we live in right now, it is a wonderful thing to have something all-encompassing that just really keeps you entertained and you know, is pleasurable to work on.
Christian, I was going to ask what reasons you do the stuff that you do or have done or are be doing. Because I thought Brian was quite, because I was going to ask Brian exactly that question. It's like, why, you know, what is it about doing sort of fan films which engages him? And he then went and said, without me prompting, but I think the same question would be good to pose at you, because your work is, there's overlaps, but it's always been very different as well.
Yeah, I think there's something wrong with me. If you've listened to the podcast before, and James and Brian know this, I mean, the podcast came out of the castorobus.com website, and the castorobus.com website came out of a conversation I had with Anthony Dry on the old Outpost Gallifrey forum, and he wanted to do a website with someone. I saw his message. We had conversations, private messages. It took about 6 months to launch. But before that, I was doing other stuff. And this is similar to a conversation I had with Philip Bates a few weeks ago, in which I learned that I cut this bit out because I'm going to save it for another podcast, that he had made fanzines at school, .2 fanzines at school and college. Now, I'd never done that, but I did write ridiculous stories and putting myself as a time traveler, which is always, you know, everyone loves the idea of traveling through time. So I'd write these crazy stories, and later on, I did a website that existed as part of the ISP. You know, you sign up to the internet, you get an ISP. They give you a bit of web hosting. There was a web space of 100 megabytes or something like that. So I created a Doctor Who website in that, and it was absolutely horrendously terrible. And even more mistakes in it than Doctor Who Online, but it was a thing that I was doing, and you know, time went on. Eventually, Castorbus came along, and you know, I just feel part of it's habitual, other parts is just having someone to express things with. There weren't many Doctor Who fans around me when I was growing up. I mean, by the time of season 26, I was the only person I knew still watching Doctor Who, even my dad wasn't watching it anymore. So, you know, everyone missed Remembrance of the Daleks. That was 25, wasn't it? Everyone missed A Curse of Fenric, I should say. And yeah, so I'm pretty sure they'd all abandoned by season 25, actually. Now think about it. But the fact remains, is basically it was me and a magazine. That was like my conversation with Doctor Who for years and years and years and years. And it sort of like expressed itself in different ways. I once submitted 2 story ideas to Virgin. Hey, we've never had this conversation before, have we?
I'm not sure.
I think we did, no.
No, we didn't. I've got them somewhere, and they were probably both terrible. One of them was not as terrible as, in fact, the one that I thought was better got the worst feedback. And it was basically the type of the rationale was, my rationale was, there was that, like, these insect creatures that were hiding in a spaceship in a lake, and they would have been destroyed in the story using some form of water. And the feedback I got from Mr. Darvel Evans, who was editor in those days, I think, was why are they hiding in the water if it's like, you know, going to kill them? To which my answer would obviously have been, well, they're in a spaceship. But, you know, there's been far worse rationales for alien involvement and hideaways and destructions on Doctor Who on television before and since then. So maybe I didn't quite get the format of the books, but maybe I did because I was reading them incessantly at the time. But yeah, that was another thing. So yeah, it had to be written word and then spoken word, I suppose, for me. I feel like I've rambled a little bit more than usual.
So So where do you think, I mean, is there an intersection between the both of you there? I'm just kind of interested in sort of why, not simply why one is a fan, because you can be a fan and just get pleasure out of watching the show, but what sort of things connect the two of you there or don't connect the two of you, which has taken that agency beyond the show into actually being, you know, productive and creative, you know, the prosumer.
It's an interesting question.
It is an interesting question. And I think obviously everybody has hobbies, right? Some people build models, some people paint, some people draw, you know, ride a bike, exercise, any degree, any level of it. And if you're not making something your career, you're at least doing that as a hobby.
Yeah.
And in many respects, some people try to turn their hobbies into the career. And I'm not saying that in a negative way. It's just a natural thing that many people do. And if you're one of those lucky people who can, good for you. But I think that's really what it is. Like when you have, in my case, for example, when you have an interest in the arts, I'm an actor, I'm a filmmaker, I'm a musician and an artist. And I've never done anything as a job officially with them. To me, it's kind of weird. I would have pursued acting. And in some ways I did. But in other ways, I always kind of preferred doing the arts for me, you know, as something I enjoy or something I like to share with others. I liked, obviously, you like the reaction from the audience if you're doing something in front of an audience. When I was in a band, that was a wonderful feeling. When I was in a play, that was a wonderful feeling. But in many respects, it kind of felt like if I were doing something like my art, when I draw, I do not like to draw to specifications. So if somebody tells me this is what the picture needs to be, this is how you need to draw it, this is what I need it to show, I don't really enjoy that, because if I try and draw a photo, I guess the best way to say this is when I sit down and I draw, I take the pen to the paper, whatever comes out on that page is what comes out in that moment. That's what I drew. If you tell me, go ahead and draw a picture of Spider-Man, I'm probably going to draw one of the worst pictures of Spider-Man you've ever seen, because it's not what I want to do or is not what I'm inclined to do in that moment. So when I make these films, which is a little bit different because obviously you do have to focus, you do have to sit down and intentionally write these, direct them, have that cinematography eye and so on. It's just that way to get that outlet, that side of me out that wants to do these things, that wants to express my interest. And a lot of times, you know, I could write my own science fiction story, but I want to play in the world of Doctor Who, and maybe that's it. Maybe there's a little bit of that kid in me that still wants to be in that world in many ways.
Is there a kid in you, Christian?
Yeah, probably. You know what I've been doing a lot of lately is playing old video games. And I think there is an aspect to what we've done, what we've been doing, what we've been talking about, that is based in kind of childhood, and also in maybe not being able to let go of it, maybe trying to understand it in a new way, and an obsession developing. I mean, back when I was writing Casterbris daily, several times a day, running the Casterbris, it was a bit obsessive, and I probably do have a slightly obsessive personality in some ways. And more recently,
what about it was obsessive though? Was it the actual practice of doing the website?
Yeah.
What was driving you in that practice? Was it the fan? Was it the you know, Doctor Who, or was it the process of creating something that circulated Doctor Who?
I think there's a bit of both of it, and doing it in a particular way that no one else was doing, and being steadfast, rightly or wrongly, in my belief that the way we were doing it was the right way to do it, and the way that the other sites were doing it was the wrong way to do it.
Well, now this is interesting then, isn't it? Because and also this goes for you as well, Brian, because I mean, obviously you've worked with people, you've worked collaboratively, and you've worked in Doctor Who cultures as well.
Right.
Where is that line of sort of proprietal, I can't say it, you know what I'm trying to say, my mouth doesn't. Where does that sit with both of you? I mean, I think that's an interesting thing as well, because that's obviously what fans are often thought about, is the ownership. Not necessarily Doctor Who in a sense, but do you know what I mean? Where did, and is that a negative thing?
You know,
go on, Brian.
I do think that every fan has a sense of ownership. You know, we all have that loyalty to that era or that version of the Doctor that we gravitate toward. And, you know, I'm sure any of us or any fan can at least relate to it, even if you felt this way at one point and changed your ways. Somebody has a conversation with you about the show. And matter of fact, to be quite frank, the buddy that I'm doing the project for that I told you about right before we started the show, he is another Doctor Who fan. And we often have conversations about this and we seem to agree. We both love Tom Baker. But when it comes to the new series, he's a Matt Smith guy. I'm a David Tennant guy. And it's funny because when we have these conversations, he'll tell me the reasons why he doesn't like David Tennant. And all of the reasons that he states are oddly the exact reasons I don't like Matt Smith. And it's so weird to sit there and point it out. But I will sit there. And when he does this, there's a part of me that has that sense of ownership that starts to take it personally. You don't like this guy that I like. Why? How could you not like that? And you have to step back and understand people have different opinions.
Could you give some examples? I'm interested that you seem to say that they're kind of almost like the same thing, but with the other Doctor. What sort of things are you talking about?
I'm going to have to try and remember some of them here, but he talks about how he does like these gurning faces. what else is there? There's certain things. He doesn't like the way he talks. His gurning faces, the way he talks. Oh man, I wish I could remember more, but I'm telling you, it is like spot on, like things I've heard about David Tennant before and things I've heard about Matt Smith before. But when we're sitting there, when he calls them out, he'll say like, I don't like this thing. And I sit there and I'm like, but that's exactly why I don't like Matt. And like, don't get me wrong. I feel bad saying that because Matt Smith, and I think I've said this before on the podcast, in person, he's a wonderful person. He absolutely is. I've met him a couple times now. He is great.
Surprisingly tall.
And his doctor... What's that?
Surprisingly tall.
Surprisingly tall. He is absolutely surprisingly tall. Mm. And his doctor has moments where I'm like, please do that more often. I would love your doctor more. So I don't want to say like his doctor's a bad doctor. Like every doctor does a fine job with the role and every doctor has their own following and so on. It's just that David Tennant in this situation speaks more to me than Matt Smith. And so when we have these conversations, it's just funny. And you know, I wish I could remember specifics now, but he and I have gone back and forth many conversations about this. And it's just hilarious whenever he says something like that, or I say something and we both just kind of like contradict each other. And it makes me wonder, should I go back and rewatch that era? Cause I know, there's a part of me that wasn't keen on the way the stories were told, but there was another part of me that wasn't like really attracted to the characters. But I'm like, will time change that? Should I give this another chance? You know, one of my absolute best friends in the world loves this character, but the things he's calling out are the things that that he's calling out my favorite, you know, version are the things that I didn't enjoy in his, and it's just an oddity. I wish I could give you better examples though.
I mean, because it's kind of interesting that, like, why, dear listener, why the hell you're listening to this, quite frankly, is one of those things which has always perplexed me. But is that kind of why you do, listener? Is there a sort of like an opposition thing that, you know, so especially if we're talking about an episode or something that's aired, do you come to a podcast, any podcast or any stream, are you looking to sort of be validated, or is it to look for the oppositions? Is it to try and understand it more? I think these are things also that fan cultures obviously do quite well, which we don't tend to in some ways talk about in any sort of positive way. We talk about it in a negative way. And there are negative things to it, isn't there? There's people who will deliberately bait, and they're doing it not because they care about the show. It's per se, it's either for financial or for, you know, social currency, fan currency. It's not a sort of very pure motive. But I am interested in that kind of thing, is how we do work in a positive way. You know, like what do we do? What we do here, I like to think, is a kind of positive space. And it's something we've always been very careful about, is to try and make sure that it's not too bickery, it's not too baity. It's informative, but it is still subjective. Because we know what we're talking about to some degree. You know, we've watched the show for a long time. That gives us some plus modifier to our character sheet. We know we are different voices. We've got, we are quite different people in a lot of ways. So we think that's good. But, you know, I think it's kind of interesting just thinking about how that exists within fandom. You know, why do people come and listen to it? Why do we need to listen to other people? What are we getting from that? And I don't know. I don't think there's any one thing, to be honest, but.
Why do we listen? Jeez, go on, Christian.
I was just going to refer to James's question about why do people listen? And I seem to recall someone once reviewed the podcast a long time ago, and they basically decided that the only reason they were listening was to see if James ever managed to agree with himself.
I didn't know that.
Oh, no.
Yeah, there was this kind of review that's basically like James having some sort of existential crisis in every single episode of the podcast, and that's why they were listening.
But, I've a few years ago, I went for a colleague. I went who was doing a sort of like a media module at university, and I as an ex, I don't really anymore, but as a media practitioner, he wanted someone in there who could tell the students what it was like. And apparently, they still ask after me if I'm all right. Is he okay?
No.
You know, if he's all right still. So, yeah. Go
on.
Yeah. No, no, go on.
Well, I was going
stop
to say
me before I question myself.
This seems somewhat slightly self-indulgent, but bear with me. I'm just going to quickly run through the four reviews that we have on Apple Podcasts. One says, my go-to Doctor Who podcast. This is the one I turn to first. They aren't running on autopilot. Automatically loving or hating everything, and the three offer differing points of view, and Brian almost always has the same opinions as I do, so I leave feeling justified. Thanks, guys. Then we have one that says, long time listener, I've been listening to it for a long time, so long I've forgotten when I started. I love your no holds barred approach to reviewing Doctor Who episodes. If you think it's good and you like it, you say so. Likewise, if you think it's pants and you don't like it, you say so. I've always appreciated that. Keep up the good work. Then we have most valued podcast. I've tried out many Doctor Who podcasts, but this is one that I value above all the rest for honest insight and substance. I may not always share their opinions, although I usually do, and even when we disagree, they never fail to provide an interesting conversation and a well-stated point of view. This is the one I look forward to. And then there's this one as well, which I'm going to do in a slightly different voice because I'm getting a bit bored.
Giving this one a listen. I like what I hear so far. Thanks.
So, you know, there's, we must be saying something, speaking in a way that the listener likes. So
okay, so here's a question to you two. I mean, I don't listen to podcasts, and I don't know whether that's because I'm too opinionated myself or it's because I'm too close to podcasting culture. I can throw the same things to you, but not just necessarily in podcasts. I mean, Brian, do you actually watch other fan films? Do you look at other pieces of work in a sort of editorial sense as one of the things you do? I know you do more than that, but or even in fiction, do you look at fan fictions? Do you look at how other people have written Doctor Who outside of, you know, the official canon?
I hate fan fiction.
I feel
somewhat at odds with, whenever I've looked at fan fiction, I've always felt, God almighty, what a thing to say, I hate it. But what I always find is that the writers feels to me that the person that has written it, and you know, this can't be the case of all of it because I haven't read all of it, but the ones that have written, read, they always seem to be coming at it from a slightly, just the wrong place. And this is not exclusive to Doctor Who fan fiction, nor is it exclusive to fan fiction. There's some professional fan fiction that has hit me in exactly the same way, both in Doctor Who, in Star Wars and Star Trek, where I just felt that what I was reading was barely related to the universe it was supposed to be set in. So I feel it's safer just to avoid it.
So does that frustration, do you think, come from? Because, I mean, obviously, you were key involvement in the sort of the Cerberus Time Worm, for instance. Mm. Is it Time Worm?
Time Leech.
That's the book. Time Leech. Yeah. Time Worm is obviously the Virgin Publications. Time Leech.
Which was restored, which was retained in the special edition of Warp Warp issues 1 and 2, which came out a few months ago, which I was really, really pleased about that they kept it in.
So do you think having that sort of interest, engagement, and I'll be honest, is there a level of competition there? And obviously, Brian, the same thing goes to you, and sort of specifically with fan films and actually cosplay, I think as well would be interesting.
Turnover. Yeah, I apologize, but first of all, just to kind of backtrack a little bit, I do watch other fan films. I do not like watch everything ever made, but if I'm on YouTube, occasionally I just do a search for them and I just check a couple of them out. I have a friend rather who just recently did a new audio series, which I have to look into since I'm such a fan of the audio series. But I do. I like to check them out. I like to see what people are doing. And, you know, sometimes they're very nitty gritty. You know, it's just a couple of friends with a camera. They're either winging it or they wrote a very base script, or sometimes they'll just, rehash TV show dialogue. And in essence, you can tell they're just having fun. They're doing what they want to do. And sometimes, you know, I watch ones where, you know, the budget and the cinematography, I sit there and I'm just like, okay, what am I even trying for? Because like, this is amazing. It's like, these people are in Hollywood themselves. I don't understand it. And they're all varying degrees. And I think what I enjoy the most is the creativity of it. You know, and it's just fun to see other people having fun in that way. And likewise, similarly with cosplay, and I've attended conventions where I was just, another guy who bought a ticket and wanted to hang out with other cosplayers, right? I've never actually gone to a convention because a certain celebrity was going to be there or anything like that. I always went because I wanted to meet other Doctor Who fans, make friends, and just kind of, you know, meet other like-minded people. But I've also gone to conventions where I worked the convention as the Doctor, as an entertainer, a fan cosplayer kind of thing. And I always approach them both the same way, which is, you know, everybody's getting dressed up as their favorite character to have fun and celebrate this thing, which is essentially bringing us all together. I only know Christian and you because of this show. I would not know either of you had this show not entered my life. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't know the friend that I heavily debate Matt Smith and David Tennant with without it. I wouldn't know many people in this world today without this show. But whenever I would go to a convention, you know, there's this thing that unfortunately, you know, the Doctor Who community, and I'm sure it's in other fandoms as well. I know it's not exclusive to this, but there was this thing I noticed during my time doing conventions, that it went from people having fun to all of a sudden, you had to be screen accurate or go home. You know, you couldn't be a real fan if you weren't wearing the real store-bought clothing items or the real tie or whatever. And just an elitist kind of view. And it was ruining things because that was no fun. I never appreciated that attitude. And I want to say that by prefacing that when I would do my cosplay of the 10th Doctor, I was very much, this needs to look like what I see on the screen. I always had that screen accuracy bug in my head, but I only ever put that on me. And that's something I've had for years. Going back even to high school, I would see an actor in a film wearing a jacket. And I would say, I would wear that jacket. That would fit my everyday aesthetic. I would wear that jacket. But I couldn't go to the store and buy something that looked like that. I had to seek out that jacket because that's my own kind of, I guess, OCD kind of little brain looking at that thing saying, I love that design. I don't want something like it. I want that. So when it came to my cosplay, I tried to make my 10th Doctor as accurate as possible because that suited my brain. And when you're at conventions, you very easily realize that you can meet other 10th Doctors who are leery of walking up to somebody who's dressed as you are if you're in a screen accurate outfit, because they think you're going to be one of those elitists. So you're met either, they either avoid you, or you're met sometimes with this cautious attitude of, is this person okay? And thankfully, I feel like I was able to overcome that, because I always just celebrated somebody who was dressed as any character, because that was the fun. That was the point of it. We were there to have fun with each other. We just want to play together. We want to be kids on the playground playing. Like, we'll goof around in character. We'll get to know each other as real people, as I did with Christian and you, you know, not just talk about the show, but talk about our real lives. And that's the amazing part to me. That's the thing. So I think a lot of the aspects of the creativity side of this show is, this show brought so many wonderful people into my life. And the fact that there are people out there who may take the time to sit down to watch a film that I wrote or I was in, and give some feedback, or even tell me that they enjoyed it, or that maybe they want to make one of their own and ask for some tips, or I can ask them for some tips. And basically, we've now gotten to know each other more than just that. Oh, you like this show? I like that show too. Well, it was nice meeting you. See you later. You know, we've actually become part of each other's lives. And I think that's one of the most beautiful things about a show like this. And I'm sure other communities like Star Wars and so on have very similar relationships. But I don't know. That's the aspect that creativity really hits hard for me, is that I look at my life today and I realize the people that I'm surrounded by, I would not know most of them were it not for this show and my being active in some kind of creative outlet with the show.
While you're listening to this Casterbus podcast, I would like to take the opportunity to draw your attention to our Apple Podcasts page. Whether you subscribe through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or you simply subscribe through an mobile app, we need your reviews on Apple Podcasts. So if you use Apple Podcasts, if you have an account there, please head over there and leave us a review. We will read it out once it is found. You will get a name check. And by leaving a review and a rating, you will help the Casterbus Doctor Who podcast reach ever greater heights. So please help us out there. If you don't feel that you're able to do that, or if you don't have an Apple account, then please follow us. You'll find the show on Facebook at facebook.com/podcasterbus. We're also on Twitter at CasterBeyond. Casterbus Doctor Who Podcasts also has a LinkedIn page, so search for us there. And you can follow us on YouTube. You can also find us on Instagram, and you'll also find Brian Terranova on Instagram, where he regularly shares his prop collection. Finally, we have a Patreon, so please consider that if you're not able to leave us a review on iTunes. Thank you very much for listening, and on with the show.
So is fandom a bit like thinking of the recent, I don't know if you watched it, but the Falcon and Winter Soldier show,
mm-hmm.
and which they were highlighting in that, which has been through various comics and various shows and stories, the idea of a serum which amplifies personalities to a degree, that, you know, the type of Captain America you would be depends upon the characteristics that you have, which become amplified, which is less to actually do, I think, to do with the chemicals of a serum, but to do with the positions of power and questions of what power does to people. And the, you know, very famous Trite axiom is axiom of power corrupting. Absolutely. So do you think that's the case that we see here in fandoms, is that where power becomes instilled, which it kind of does, not necessarily because one takes up power, but because people give you power because they think you as either being someone who's extremely knowledgeable, or someone who visually, so as you say, has got that sort of look which kind of suggests they are really into this and they know their stuff, they know the right people to get their costume elements. And it's almost that sort of becomes a part of the dangers, where that power gives them what personality parts that it sort of amplifies.
I think it, you know, we could take this back to the old saying, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely, kind of thing, right? But I don't believe that statement wholeheartedly. I think what it is that there people have certain personalities and people are certain ways. And yes, people can change. You know, obviously there's always that aspect. But if you are the type of person that craves attention, you know, you may get into acting. And that's not to discredit any actors out there for the craft that they're doing. But a lot of them, you know, I'm an actor. It's wonderful to be on the stage and get that applause, you know. And you could take that as gracefully as David Tennant does and just be the wonderful person that we always hear the stories about him to be. Or, you know, and we've all heard some stories of some actors out there who just have no time for the fans, who are dreadfully rude to the fans. And to them, they're just doing their job and leave them alone kind of thing. But what I think happens is you get into it. Say you're a really great cosplayer. You're a really great person. You get into this. People really appreciate what you're doing. Maybe you start your own fan page or something like that because you've gotten that much attention and people keep constantly asking you about it. So you think, maybe I'll do something with this. And then other people notice that, but you're a genuinely nice person. And, you know, like you're helping the community. You're showing them where you got all your stuff. You're helping them figure out how to make the things they want to make. You're giving them tips on the costume or how to portray the character, whatever. All these things that you would never think in a million years are something that you personally would be doing. But maybe you're doing that now. Somebody else will see that. And this is where I think the absolute power bit comes in. Somebody else is going to see that and see that as their way to do the same thing, but their ego is already in place. I don't think that they're being amplified or changed by the power. I think the ego is already there. What they've done is find an outlet where they think they can dominate and become the big player. And, you know, unfortunately, that's where you get a lot of the elitists from. Is they're waiting in the wings. They were always looking for something to be an elitist about, and they found an angle because they too enjoy this show and thought, oh, I can do that, and unfortunately take things in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I think it's true that I've seen people sort of horizontally shift between fan bases and take up the similar sort of situation. The same sort of results occur, and then they move to another fan base and they'll do the same again.
Mm.
Absolutely.
It's interesting. I think, I mean, because fans is just such a massive, complex thing to talk about. And I think it's kind of interesting to sort of look at it in that sort of way of where the positives are. These negatives, I think we've all endured them in various ways. And obviously, Brian's mentioned some. I know I have and Christian has as well in terms of Doctor Who. I must admit, as I've got older, I think I've always wondered, for me, I think as social media and as digital media has made it so much easier for people to have a voice, I've had less interest in having a voice. I kind of like my fandom, I think for me, is a quite personal thing where I quite like to sit and absorb information on props. I find, you know, Brian's focus on the details of Sonic Screwdrivers, even though I'm not particularly into Sonic Screwdrivers, I find that really interesting.
Mm.
And I think one thing I think fans bring to a show or to any product, which I would like to think that shows should embrace, and some of them, like Doctor Who does, is that that fans will look for those sort of things. And I know, I think we've said this before, Brian, will look for things which official people working within the show will either miss or will get lost in the past. And it's, you know, sure. It's those fans who will do that archiving, that searching, that finding out that information, which eventually can be quite interesting because it's, you know, it's information of human cultures, of human practice, of human values and things which give people meaning. And it gets lost in that, especially a show like this where the history is so long. And I think it's amazing when you see stuff come up on Twitter of things that people have found or things that people have noticed, which have largely gone unnoticed before. And you wouldn't have that if you didn't have that sort of fan interest that sort of, you know, generates and finds this material.
Yeah, that was...
Yeah, absolutely. And
what a pause.
Christian, you go ahead.
No, I was going to say that. I mean, that was that whole sort of discovery thing, that was very much part of... A lot of that happened in the 90s with older Doctor Who, didn't it? When Doctor Who magazine got a hold of all these archive photos from the BBC and started using them and investigating things better with the Pixley archives and what have you, and there was more of an awareness of what had been done, what had been used, what props that had been reused, sets that had been reused, scripts that had been abandoned, and people who had played parts who had maybe been sort of forgotten, or you know, there was no IMDb, so people didn't really know what else they'd done, that kind of thing. And things like something that's mentioned quite a lot these days, Delia Derbyshire and her involvement, which was kind of very much played down back then, even though you know, things have changed a lot more now. It was only around that sort of time, late 90s, early 2000s, where her name was becoming more and more well known and synonymous with electronic music and electronic music pioneering. So what's interesting is in that side of thing, then seeing things on Twitter, people sharing photos on Twitter or on Facebook or whatever, and noticing things and seeing those things for the first time, even though it's not the first time that these things have been kind of like popularly realized.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I like things like, I've used him far too many times, but things like Clayton Hickman's threads, where, you know, the colorization threads that he'll do, is it Babel Vision, Babel Color? Does as well, of actual pieces of footage or of photos, and that ways of trying to bring these images to life in a way which is authentic, where, you know, the key goal of that fan or professional fan is to see if they can actually best recreate what that would look like in the flesh outside of a monochrome photo. And, you know, things like that are fascinating. Well, there's one, I think I might have mentioned before, the last couple of years, which fascinated me, which was just simply on Legopolis. And there was a conversation and debate over how some of the scenes were shot around the lay-by, and questions about the exterior, the police box exteriors and the conditions of them compared to the shooting schedules. And some mysteries there. And again, it's not really about, you know, Doctor Who, or as a lot of, you know, people like to sort of dismiss as, oh, Doctor Who is about episode 6, page 41, you know, what did so-and-so mean? It's like, well, yeah, it can be a bit like that, but it can be equally as anal in different ways. It can be about production schedule 6, shooting a.m., you know, at 10 a.m. How does that fit with you? Let me know. And it's still as anal, but it's in a different way, and I think that's really fascinating because it just tells us so much about, I don't know, I mean, about history. It talks about practices, doesn't it? It talks about our interest to try and engage in the past. And none of this would be there if it wasn't for that sort of fan, which is often lampooned, when in the effect, you know, that is really interesting. And I'm kind of glad more and more they get more credibility. I don't know. I'm just...
Well, I mean, without some form of, you know, archivist or archival or fan or whatever, we wouldn't know of, you know, Greek philosophers, would we? You know, those things were kept and recorded by archivists. So, although I mean, maybe, you know, the details of recording a scene on a dual carriageway maybe not quite the same as Aristotle or whatever, it is something that is interesting to people and therefore needs to be retained. Do you know what I've remembered recently, and it's just come to me again? We've been, the whole Casterbus thing is essentially, prior to the podcast, I mean, it's basically a fanzine on the web, and Casterbus magazine is obviously a fanzine in print, mostly in PDF. But James and I both worked on two publications.
Yeah,
which I'd forgotten about. One of them I hadn't forgotten about, which was the charity thing with a strange name that Elton Town and Jones edited. And then the other thing was we both worked on.
Oh,
the same...
yes, I forgot about that.
Yeah,
sorry.
Oblique. It will come to me. It'll be in the show notes. But do you think we both worked on an issue of DWAS, didn't we?
Yeah, worked on a couple of issues of that.
Yeah, and I'd forgotten about it until I actually stumbled. I either stumbled across it, or I stumbled across the text on my computer, what I'd actually submitted. And I mean, that's a whole another dimension. of fans doing things, isn't it? This, like, not only is it a fanzine, Celestial Toy Room, it's one that's been going for decades. So it's like it's been part of quite an illustrious list of people who have contributed before you.
Well, it's that whole thing, isn't it? That you know, that we are always constantly searching for ourselves through our own archives, that in all archives of existence, of our reality. You know, we try and define ourselves by our understandings of the past. So much of that, and these sort of minor things. I mean, I suppose people become fascinated about a lay-by and a production because it's them trying to sort of find understanding or meaning within, not through that show, that sort of time of their life as well.
What were you doing when they were doing that?
Exactly. Yeah. And even if it was before you were born, again, you're still trying to find meaning because it might be something you're trying to understand because it might relate maybe to your parents. You might be thinking, well, that's when my parents were alive. That's what it was like. Was this what it was like before I was alive? This, you know, especially with TV and film, where it's not like an old book where you've got a drawing. You've got actual evidence of life going on there, that life existed, really existed when you weren't there.
Do you know what really gets me? That whole idea of that, and the fact that when we were born, sort of mid-1970s, and prior to that, there was this kind of bizarre cross-pollination of fashions and styles whereby people had sort of like longish hair and sideburns. Everything's photographed in color, but you've got all these pop stars and that dressing like Victorians. That absolutely played out. When I was like 12, 13, 14, that idea of that look in that time just before I was born absolutely played havoc with my synapses. It just kept me awake, baffled and at the wonderment of people dressing like the past. When was I actually born? Was I born then, or was I born 100 years before? It just really, really fascinated me.
Because it's like almost two areas of fandom that we're talking about. We're talking about fandom as a form of nostalgia, and obviously fandom as like a form of event, which they can be both interlinked. But like when Brian's talking about, you know, doing cosplay at a convention, while it's a celebration of something that's been ongoing or has a past, is very much tied into the moment and people meeting each other, the socialization, while there's that other side of fandom, which Brian is equally involved in terms of trying to recreate the past and trying to get the perfect sonic screwdriver, you know, with the perfect right metallic gray, as I think I recall from one of the Tenant props that I remember you talking about years ago, which has always stuck with me. That sort of thing is really interesting. So you've got those two sort of sides of it, which sometimes come together and sometimes sit very separate.
It's
like when I speak, there's these really awkward pauses. I feel like, well, what the fuck am I going to say after that? It's just like, I don't know.
It's all part of making you feel welcome here today. No, it's a good point because, I mean, if you look at fandom as a whole, you know, we're focusing on like creative outlets and so on. And, you know, there are a lot of ways to be creative. You know, I have another friend who does pixel art for any fandom. Doctor Who is one of them, but it, you know, that's his outlet. And he goes to conventions, sells lots of his art, which is all just made in pixel form, which looks like, you know, old video games, essentially, you know. Mm-hmm. But that's the outlet. And you know, everybody has their muse or their inspiration. You know, some people like to paint horses. Some people like to paint houses, sunsets, and so on. And not to say that somebody like Nathan, who I should plug him there, Pixel Who, Nathan from Pixel Who, anyway, is the pixel art guy. I'm sure he does more than just the pixel art and, you know, pixel things for nerd fandoms and so on. But nerd fandoms are people who definitely help pay the bills because everybody's seeking to collect things like that. So you're either one who creates or one who collects, or somebody like, you know, James yourself. You know, I know you have like an odd trinket here or there, but the most that I know about you and your collecting is you enjoy the show, but you seem to like to do, you know, like a thesis on aspects of the show. You know, you wrote a whole piece on police boxes and so on. You and I have talked many times about these things, but how, that's your outlet, and how do you come to that kind of creative side?
It's still, someone's worked out my position here. The deflector. The deflector by taking the role of the interviewer.
It's a unique perspective, though, because of the way that you're doing your pieces. You know, you're doing them at school on your level, right? You're not putting them out there for fandom for the most part, if I'm not mistaken.
They will be published. Well, that one will be published eventually, but yeah, I know what you mean. Yes, it's not. I think for me, a lot of looking at those sort of things, I'm doing another one on another fandom as well. In a weird way, I think, again, it still ties into reconciling stuff in our own understanding. I think for me, growing up, I had a fascination, a bit like you, Brian, on terms of very material things to do with a show. So like the sonic screwdriver for you, I don't know, teleport bracelets from Blake 7, police boxes, blasters, lightsabers. You know, the intricacies of those sort of things were very fascinating to me, but I had no one to share that with. To me, I felt quite unusual. And I wonder sometimes, I think, what fandom has been for the last, certainly last 40 years, but more so probably in the last 20, 25, a place where people can sort of, you know, not wanting to devalue the term by, I suppose it's not really, people coming out of the closet in a weird way of their fandom, something which they felt is something that's been, that they've repressed because it was either laughed upon or they didn't know anyone else who really enjoyed it in the same way that they did. And it's a space where that can sort of be understood by feeling more normal. And I certainly found sort of researching fandoms and, you know, finding out that people also had fascinations in police boxes with broken lights, or in production schedules, or in the fact that the Millennium Falcon prop and exteriors can't match, which still upsets me greatly.
We've been playing Battlefront, Bruce and I, Battlefront 1 for the Xbox One. So it's the one that came out about 2015. And on that very note, Bruce was walking across the top of the Millennium Falcon in a combat situation, looked at the cockpit and said to me, there's no way they can both fit, all three of them can fit in there. Or all five of them, whatever, depending on, you know, the scene or whatever. No way, it's too small. Sorry to interrupt. Carry on.
It's a cruel realization of someone who likes that sort of stuff when that happens. You know, when you find out the Defiant in Star Trek was like four different sizes, and you know there is no consistency. Oh. Yeah, it's and you want to try and work out what that is. And I suppose to some degree, a lot of fandom is turning to others to try and understand why we like things. You know, why do I like these things? That's why I think people perhaps listen to this golden garbage is that, you know, we are discussing things which do interest them, and it can sort of maybe help a person listening to this conjure up their own perspective and their own ideas
about your existential struggle.
Or what?
About your existential struggle.
Yeah. Or they could be there just to help me get through my existential crisis. They didn't. What did they used to call me at school? They used to call me midlife crisis at school.
Come on.
Seriously, they did. They called me midlife crisis. No, it wasn't like a major common name, but I remember being called, a couple of friends of mine, like, yeah, you're midlife crisis. Because I was always coming close to that sort of middle-aged breakdown. But yeah, I think a lot of it is to do that. It's just trying to try and work out what the hell we like this stuff. And we find out other people. When I found out other people loved the black hole, blew me away. I went years and years, you know, decades without realizing anyone else liked that film bar me.
Oh, Kavanagh likes black hole.
Yeah, and it's not just me. And I think that's something I think fandom kind of brings. When you have an intense interest in someone, something, having other people around somehow makes that intensity seem somewhat less crazy. It seems a little more normal. And I think also it can be a very collective thing, can't it? Because you start, there's a certain lexicon that comes with fandoms, which are very close. So it's not just any fandom, but fandoms which are quite specific will start sharing, you know, I know it can be small things like, you know, the old, I can't stand the confusion going in my mind, that sort of thing. Or, you know, a joke about the Nymon or Time and the Rani, or, you know, and then I turned around and they were all wearing eye patches. You know, these sort of things become part of a shared humor, a shared social space, don't they? And I think that also can be very invigorating as a person. I'm not quite sure why. Am I invigorated by that?
No, I'd go along with that. I find that kind of thing. I mean, it's all useful and good in a social situation, whether it's like one on one in a group, physically or online like this. It's like we all have this sort of like common, the vocab that we can just slip back to in moments of dead air. I mean, I mentioned Gareth Cavanagh just now.
Why haven't you used any today?
I know. I mentioned Gareth earlier, and obviously he's kind of, I don't want to dwell too much on what he does because he's on quite often, and we talk about his fanzine projects quite often. And then, you know, two podcasts ago he was on, we were talking about Brian Blessed and Omega and all that sort of stuff. So he takes it to a completely different level. Maybe we're slightly guilty not actually having him on here for this, but maybe on the other hand, we maybe need to be taking a more holistic view of the whole thing. But he does things in completely next level fanzines, and it's not all him. There's also Colin Brockhurst doing this amazing layout and editing. Gareth's really the producer. And there's these plays that he's produced, these productions. And now he's moving into the audio space. It has been with the last Warp, which had an audio adventure with Daleks, voiced by David Graham in, and or a Dalek adventure. And there's definitely David Graham in there anyway. And then now there's the whole Brian Blessed thing just blows my mind. Brian Blessed blows my mind, to be honest with you. But you know, having him in a fan production is just amazing. It's kind of inspiring in some ways. We were talking earlier before we started recording, well, before you started recording, about what we've been doing lately. And I'm working on a script for a sitcom that I started like 10, 11 years ago, and a new version of that script. And what I intend to do once I have a slightly better working space arrangement is what some people in a group that I've been doing is producing their own sitcoms as podcasts, and I'm intending to do that with this, and seeing how they've done that, and they've got Brian Blessed and they've got these other great actors, and you know, all I need in comparison is a small handful of actors and a few sound effects. I feel like that's achievable now, whereas before it was like, I'm writing this purely for myself because no one's going to be interested in it. Now I can share it, you know? So, I mean, and that's beyond Doctor Who. And I suppose then for people who are inclined, I would say you, Brian, but I think you're probably in the same sort of level of expertise to inspire other people rather than be so much inspired yourself. It's this whole kind of one begets another, doesn't it? Everything inspired by something else inspires something new, and I think that is the beauty of it. Whether or not we're talking about a show that we're watching actively or not, whether we have a favorite era or not, whether you know, it's still there, and there's still some interest and love and obsession to find a way of expressing.
I think it's also because it's so, you know, when we talk about things like Doctor Who, it's so big. And when it's so big. Unless you are one of these sort of elite fans who seem to like to believe that they know everything about a show, you can't. And even if you did know all the things which were in print, everything that was there, interpreting that into different positions, different perspective, different ideas, Not one person can do that alone.
No,
and you can't rely on the show itself if you're lucky enough for it to be an ongoing franchise to be able to cover all that ground as well, because it's moving forward all the time, doing new things. So you know, I think that's the other good thing about fandoms, is it can sort of, it's there en masse, because you need that amount of people to sort of really be able to dissect it and find interesting things in there without getting bored. You need to be able to sort of work off each other, you know, let each other sort of trigger different ideas and different thoughts and different avenues and different ways of being creative. And I think this really benefits the show. I think that's probably my real final point on this that I like about it, is there is, certainly especially in the last 20 years as well, we have seen shows and franchises become very aware of those fan groups, aware of what they say and how they act. Sometimes, as Christian pointed out, they either come from those fan groups or they are massively you know, into these fans. They were part of them or interested in them. And so you get this good synergy going on, which keeps the franchise going. Because, you know, we're not in a position where, you know, Doctor Who is a definite future. Not because we're saying it's bad and it's going to end, but because television is ongoing, it's constantly changing. Yeah, things come and they go. A show that's lasted for 15 years or so since its, you know, most recent production, that's a damn good legacy. But there's no reason it has to be going for another 15. And one of the things that keeps it going is people being interested in it. I'm not saying that I believe that fan campaigns keep things going, but I think general interest in a show is dynamic, and it can demonstrate, and it's visible as well. I think that is a really important way of keeping things going, keeping people's interest. You know, we can get bored with something if we don't have someone else to go, hey, what about if you see it in this light? And I think that is really important. And I kind of hope that we do have a little part in that, in these sort of these tired little podcasts. I feel like we're sort of like, our podcast is, I don't know, in its golden age, golden years. It's still alive, still going, but it's a little creaky, maybe. It's not like we try and keep up with the younguns. So
I hear there are other Doctor Who podcasts.
Possibly.
No. Get out of town.
No.
What would they have to say?
I have no idea. Seriously. Yeah, no, really, no.
It's like we covered a little bit earlier, right? Like we talked about David Tennant. Well, I talked about David Tennant, Peter Capaldi being in the show and having been fans. You know, yes, Peter Capaldi even having written a letter to Doctor Who magazine. Yeah. You know, of course, there's Stephen Moffat and Russell T. Davis as well. And Stephen Moffat got to write a comedy Doctor Who skit. Russell T. Davis is actually now working with Big Finish to release a story that he wrote when he was not working on the show. It was something that was when he was a fan watching the show when Colin Baker was the Doctor. It's a story that he wrote that now they're going to produce. Where would you be without Nick Briggs and Russell? Yeah, William Russell. Not William Russell. What am I saying? Or Gary Russell. Done all of the BBV productions.
Yeah, I was going to mention them earlier because they're all hitting YouTube like officially now, aren't they?
Big Finish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Like,
but even those things.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say things like that, and like with Big Finish, had followed it, are primarily sustained by those more intense groups of consumers, the fans. You know, the fans will be the ones who'll buy Big Finish more likely than someone who just dips in.
And... Well, absolutely. But difference, Big Finish is BBC licensed, right?
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
BBV videos, Mythmaker videos, all the things that Gary and Nick did. Imagine if they weren't allowed to do those things. If they were throttled the way the Star Trek community has been throttled by Paramount, would Nick Briggs be the voice of the Daleks today? Or would he be doing something else? Maybe he'd still be in Hollywood. Maybe he'd writing some other way. Or I say Hollywood, but you know what I mean, in the film industry. But would he be the voice of the Daleks? You know, I wonder about those things, because if the creative outlet, if you haven't had the time to hone those skills, would you be here? Would you be doing them? You know, clearly, I don't know about David Tennant having done any fan productions, but I know that he begged to do Big Finish plays when they first started because he wanted to be in Doctor Who, and then eventually he played the Doctor, you know. And it's just a very interesting thing. Where would we be if we weren't allowed to have the creative outlets that we're allowed to have, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Big Finish, yeah, those Mythmakers and Shakedown and all those, and how they, as you say, put people in a position to actually create Big Finish, to become part of Doctor Who, for Doctor Who to become really such part of Big Finish. You know, we're obviously talking just after the release of the Christopher Eccleston line on Big Finish, which is something, you know, never would have imagined a few years ago. There's a real incredible intersection that occurs that sustains the show, sustains the franchise through fans, beyond fans being these sort of nerdy, angry people shouting on Outpost Gallifrey or whatever, which is kind of where they often sit in sometimes in how people see that sort of culture, which is a shame.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. We need to find a way to wrap this up, and I'm a bit stuck.
How about, and then I turned around and they were all wearing podcasts.
Jeez. the end.
Very, very, very amusing, James McLean. Listen, Mr. Miss Listener, you may or may not have been written by Roger Hargreaves. I do not know. Either way, if you have something that you want to share with us, there's a creation or yourself or something that you've seen that you think is rather awesome, you'll maybe find this podcast on Facebook or on Twitter. Just share it with us and we'll check it out. Even if it is fan fiction, I'll just get someone else to read it. You've been listening to the podcast with a K from castorbis.co.uk, and you'll find us in various places online. As mentioned in the middle of the podcast earlier, so I don't know why I'm doing this bit. I want to thank James McLean and Brian Terranova for waking up and joining me this month. We'll be back with another podcast in due course. In the meantime, check out the archive, which has been refreshed constantly and remastered, like I'm Jimmy Page doing the old Led Zeppelins in some sort of 4K surround or whatever. Until next time, it's goodbye from us.